Hi, I'm Tyra G, your host of Frankly Speaking with Tyra G. Welcome again to our virtual global gathering of phenomenal women and those of you who love them. Yes, you. Mothers, daughters, grand and great grandmothers, fearsome and generous, humble and honest, in pursuit of new possibilities and purpose. You know, here we dig deep and we come up strong. For those of you joining us for the first time, each month we explore a new theme inspired by you. Yes, I said you. We bravely walk into places where tradition has taught us there are some things that we just don't talk about, but not at this table. And no matter how hard judgment tries to get in, it can't. Beloved, here we live beyond the wreckage. Every week, we experience, educate, encourage, and empower each other. We share aha moments and stories that have been left in our pockets for far too long. Every week, we start right where we are. I am so excited about the show and how it's progressing. You know, it's our 10th month. I have proof now that dreams can come true. Frankly Speaking with Tyra G was one of my most precious dreams. I thank God for each one of you. Your gifts of encouragement, your ideas, your presence, they all inspire me. You all know I can't do this show without you, right? Thank you so very much. You're listening to Radio Fairfax, Fairfax, Virginia on your TV, computer, or mobile device, and we are webcast worldwide on the internet at www.radiofairfax.org every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Should you miss us, no worries. You can catch our podcast. You just turn to YouTube, key in Frankly Speaking with Tyra G. And if you feel like connecting with me offline, it's easy, and you know how much I love that, right? Email me at tyra@tyragarlington.com. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you, Courtney Nero, for composing and performing our Frankly Speaking theme song. And thank you for naming it I'm Listening. Our theme these 2 months is Courageous Conversations. Two big words, one big theme. And sometimes it's uncomfortable to walk into that space. But for us to get a return on our investment, we need to make an investment. We need to be authentic and vulnerable. We're going to have to be perfectly imperfect. And to receive and love information about issues that may be uncomfortable to think about, deal with, anticipate, and forgive. We're going to contemplate, evaluate, learn about, be surprised, and celebrate. I received great feedback from our first two Courageous Conversations. Miss Sunny Crow revealed her journey as she faced breast cancer, not once, but twice. She let us eavesdrop on her conversation she had with herself, her family, her doctors, and her coworkers. I even jumped into that conversation and shared my lack of courage when I received my unexpected brain tumor diagnosis. What we have discovered during the show is that the ability to have a courageous conversation is often the result of a process, a journey, not an event. It doesn't always happen when it's logical to have one that you're able to do it. Sometimes you have to grow into it. And sometimes courageous conversations happen in and stay in our heads or our hearts. Sometimes our courageous conversations are dressed in silence. We all have times or seasons when it requires courage to make it from one moment to the next, to take the next step or say the next word. And sometimes we let fear and shame and guilt demonize our potential to overcome. But for now, for today, we're going to pause in a place where we can be one another's mirrors. Our goal is to better understand topics that don't make it into polite conversations or the dinner table. We're going to look beyond and behind terms like human trafficking, domestic violence, child abuse, opioid poisoning, homelessness, developmental and intellectual disabilities. And we're going to look into their potential causes, effects, victims, stakeholders, and the necessary conversations that result. Today's topic is not comfortable. And I want to create a common thought space for you today with a quote for someone who walked in that space. And I quote, "I married my ex-husband in October 2005, thinking he was kind, gentle, compassionate, and caring. Not until I was pregnant with our child did I see his true character. When I was about 6 months pregnant, he slapped me across my face, leaving me with a black eye and knocking me to the ground. Luckily, nothing happened to my baby. But the abuse didn't end there. At the time I was living in Ecuador, I was trapped and scared. My daughter was born in June 2007, and we traveled to the U.S. permanently in August of 2007. Once there, he did not hold back. Just 3 weeks after arriving in the U.S., there had already been 3 calls made to the police on domestic disputes. And he was arrested for battering me while I had our infant daughter in my arms. As I tried to call 911, he ripped the phone cord out of the wall. He threatened me that if I testified against him, he would kill me. And I believed him. Rape was a regular occurrence in our home, and I cannot count the number of times I laid in bed crying as he raped me. He also strangled me on a regular basis, slammed my head into the walls of our home, leaving large holes, tortured me sexually, mentally, psychologically, and ruined me financially. He hit our 3-year-old daughter in the face, leaving a large bruise, then kept her home from school for several days until the bruise was no longer visible. He put her head through our bathroom wall, which was reported to the Illinois DCFS. Department of Children and Family Services. DCFS decided that he did in fact abuse our daughter, but they did not pursue the case any further. I tried to protect her from him, but every time he would hit her, I would step in and receive my own beating on her behalf. I did not report it since I was sure he would kill me or kidnap our daughter. There is something that you just don't hear about. Survivors speak and they go from their abuse to what they are currently doing, not describing enough of the true gut-wrenching feelings that you have in the days, weeks, months after you leave. Life after abuse is so positive, but truth be told, sometimes you feel it's harder than the abuse. There are many great programs that will help you with transitions from where you've been or where you will be. The Victim Compensation Fund is a great program that will help with mental health therapy, relocation, and many other things. After almost 8 years, I want you to hear this, since my abuse, I still deal with my after. There are still days that I apologize incessantly, cry at the drop of a hat, feel totally worthless, and take the weight of the world on my shoulders. I still don't let people see beyond the mask of total happiness. I want you to pause there, and I want you to think about the words, the language, and the courage it took to share it. After our break, we're going to meet a woman who walks with authority, compassion, knowledge, and experience in the space called domestic violence. You'll want to stay close now. And we are back. Let's talk. I'd like for you to meet Ms. Nicole Acosta. I play a game with my guest. I ask them please to introduce themselves. And very often, they go, really? What am I supposed to do? So I say, pretend you're a best-selling book, and we are reading you, and we want you to tell us things that will keep us turning the pages. So how did you get to be you?
So I'm a clinical social worker as a profession, and when I first started my career in social work, I was really interested in helping families be stronger. And I did an internship at a domestic violence program at 21 years old and just fell in love with that work. I was really drawn to the help that we can provide to families solving the tremendous challenges they were facing, but also domestic violence work involves so many people and systems in order to solve the problem system-wide and community-wide. So that combination of working with our partners and working with families directly was something that I fell in love with, and I've been doing domestic violence work since then.
Well, here's my question. Mm-hmm. You said you were 21. Mm-hmm. I remember me at 21, and I didn't go to graduate school until 3 years later, where I had to face things that may be similar. Where did you get the courage to walk into that place and enjoy it? It's not pretty.
That's a great question. I don't know. That's sometimes I look back and think, where did I have the audacity to think at 21 I could change the world that way? But I think having good mentors and having really strong women who had done this work for decades and decades, mm-hmm. the people that I could look up to and that I could rely on to teach me the lessons they've learned was something that helped me to fall into the work more comfortably.
And I'm thinking, as I said that to you, at 21, we're pretty bold anyway, aren't we? We don't know what we don't know. So that was probably a good time for you to walk through the door. You mentioned your mentors. What kind of women were they? Talk to us about them.
So these were women who started domestic violence programs in the early 1980s when the movement of domestic violence work was really starting to take off across the country and here in Virginia as well.
Uh-huh.
So these were women who had been doing the work since that time. Most of them started as volunteers in their communities who understood that there were needs that needed to be met with women who were facing violence and built shelters on their own or with donations and community support, mm-hmm. and then built these programs to be what they are today.
Let me ask you this. You talked about the 80s. We know domestic violence has been around since the beginning of time. What were the triggers that made the 80s that point where people took off the blinders, even though they may not have known what they were talking about or doing? They said, we have a problem.
Well, I think that road was paved before the 80s with the civil rights movement and the equal rights movement for women. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, and it just took the laws a long time to catch up. So around the 80s and 90s is when nationally we started to see federal funding available, mm-hmm. for programs that served victims of domestic violence. And then in 1994, when the Violence Against Women Act was passed,
right. It
was a game changer for those programs to be able to really invest in their programs and add staffing and resources to help the victims that they were serving.
You compared this or said it was built on the foundation of civil rights, human rights, women's rights. Mm-hmm. One thing I learned is you can legislate behavior, but not attitudes. So, all right, so now we've got programs. We've got money to staff them. We have requirements now that say you need this skill set in order to stay in this space. What were some of the major issues? I mean, there had to be issues breaking in. I mean, there was a lot of denial going on, as I remember it.
Absolutely. And I would say, even though we've come a long way, mm-hmm. in terms of societal norms and what's acceptable,
right?
We still have a ways to go. I think some of the challenges were how do all these systems that interact with victims mm-hmm. and offenders on a daily basis, how are they going to work together towards a common mission? You've got, you know, victim service agencies helping survivors. You have law enforcement who have the tough job of every single day intervening in violent situations that are incredibly dangerous.
Right.
You have our court systems that are in a place to make really important decisions for the families that come before them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got other allied professionals, as we call it in our field. So
right.
mental health providers,
mm-hmm.
Medical providers, folks who see victims of domestic violence all the time, who walk through their doors and their systems and are in a place to intervene.
I'm going to read, just to kind of talk about the size of the bread box, I'm going to read a few facts to help our listeners. By the way, Nicole, our listeners are international as well as intergenerational. And when we talk about things that are going on in Virginia, they might know where Virginia is, but we want to just make sure they understand. Okay, fact, 4,774,000 women in the U.S. experience physical violence by an intimate partner. Everybody hear that? Intimate partner every year. Fact, each year, 2 million injuries and 1,300 injuries and 1,300 deaths every day by an intimate partner. This one is scary. Fact, ages 18 through 24 are at greatest risk of experiencing domestic violence. Fact, every 9 seconds in the U.S., a woman is a victim of domestic violence. And this one we're going to talk about further, but I'll just lay it out now. Domestic violence has long-term effects. It can negatively impact a woman's mental health, physical health, productivity, earning potential, and overall financial security. Hear me when I say this. Her children's mental well-being is also at risk of long-term damage. Now, I use the term domestic violence about 4 times. Let's slow the roll. How would you operationally define domestic violence? What are we talking about?
So we define domestic violence as a pattern of coercive behavior and abusive behavior within the context of an intimate relationship
mm-hmm.
in order to have power and control over another person.
Give us an example of a domestic violence situation.
So often when we hear domestic violence, we think of potentially one partner physically assaulting another partner.
Mm-hmm.
And that is absolutely one element of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes much deeper than that. And mm-hmm. it generally includes a pattern of behavior to have power and control over another person. So that could mean also through psychological abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Often in domestic violence relationships, there's an element of sexual assault or sexual coercion in the
mm-hmm.
relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It can mean financially abusing your partner. It can also mean spiritually abusing your partner, using that person's spiritual beliefs or religious beliefs in a way to keep them controlled
mm-hmm.
within the relationship. So there's a wide range of behaviors that can be included within that pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And the physical abuse is very dangerous and can really impact one's health. But that emotional abuse can often create very long-lasting
mm-hmm.
effects in the person who's receiving.
I think some of the effects can even fall into the basket of PTSD.
Absolutely.
I also want to mention, as you hear us, you may think about someone you know, a friend, a sibling, a parent, a child, that is experiencing, and I wanted you to hear Nicole, she said pattern. One event does not a pattern make. So we're talking about repetitive behavior. But some of the words that I picked up as well in preparing to speak with you was jealousy, intense jealousy. And to me, jealousy is a point of control, okay? But isolation, so that you're separated from your peeps, from your tribe, from your team, and you're with that person. Guilting, making us feel guilty if we behave a certain way. When you talked about agencies, and we talked about allied health, et cetera, you didn't mention, or I didn't hear you mention, education or educators. Are educators sometimes those who see and report?
Absolutely. I think educators are in a position where they see our children every single day, and they know, they sometimes know our children just as well maybe as we might, and they see when one of their students is not doing well, is anxious, acting out,
mm-hmm.
overly tired, a host of signs.
That's a good one.
That they're able to, and they're in a unique position to be able to intervene,
mm-hmm.
because they have access to that child, they have access to the child's family.
And so, okay, as we even dig deeper on that one, I was blessed to be in the classroom before I became a principal. And sometimes, as a teacher, the relationship with the child was so trusting that they would report something. And I got involved one time with a situation and was guided through a very wise principal and social worker. There are limits to what you can raise a flag, but parents and children's relationship, talk about what I'm talking about. What am I talking
about? Sure. So you are right. There are limits, but that's why it's so important that all these systems work together, because
mm-hmm.
we each have a role. We each have a role we can play in mm-hmm. preventing domestic violence or from stopping it from happening.
Mm-hmm.
So just raising that flag means it's time for another system to help step in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important place for an educator to be in.
Yeah. Do you feel that teacher training is sufficient or supported? I know schools have psychologists and nurses, and you know, you got the principal, and then sometimes they have law enforcement. And I also heard you say, and I want to say this again, they have to come together as a team. They have to put the child in the center and focus on that. But let's play out something. All right, Johnny's in school. Johnny and Jane. Johnny's in school, and I notice a change in behavior. Acting out aggressively when not acting out, sleeping. Hygiene not like what it used to be. As a teacher, what might I do? Or as a friend, as a mother who maybe is carpooling this child, what could I do at that point? Because I've observed something and it's over a period of time and I want to help. What could I do?
Well, I think the first thing to do is just to check in with that child and just ask how they're doing, and making sure that every interaction you have with them is one that's positive and supportive.
Because mm-hmm.
even if they don't tell you initially what's happening, they need to know who safe adults are that they can trust and go to.
That's a good one. Safe adults, trust.
And then the other thing is telling someone else, because it does take a village in a sense of supporting children and making sure our families and our communities are supported. So telling the other teachers or professionals that you're working with, if you're in that role,
mm-hmm.
if you're just a parent, then also if you feel like it's safe, reaching out to that child's parent and just saying, hey, how's it going? How are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Because one thing you mentioned earlier is that victims of domestic violence are often isolated from friends and families and
yes,
peers.
Yes, yes, yes.
As a power and control tactic from the person abusing them.
Right.
So making sure that they know that they have someone they can go to. I wouldn't expect that they would open up to you right away, because they're going to test to see if it's a trustworthy situation, if you're a person they can talk to and they can trust. But letting them know that you're here for them when they are ready to talk is an important step.
I like that. For me, the issue has been, yes, it's trust and it's safe. However, not pushing. you know, just, and then modeling behavior. The one thing I've known about young people, children, babies, they have a great power of discernment. And when they see over a period of time who you are, they can make their way, but you have to be alert. Let's role play this. Okay, we've seen this. It's a school, and the principal has called the mommy in to sit down with the teacher and say, hey, we've noticed some behavioral changes in Johnny, and, you know, we're a little concerned, and we want to talk to you. And all of a sudden, she snaps at you, calls you every name in the book, and tells you what rights you don't have. What kind of things have you seen happen? I know it's happened. What kinds of things have you seen work through as a result of that kind of attitude?
Well, I think when anyone responds that way, the first thing you want to know is where is this coming from, and approaching that person from a place of concern and empathy for what they're feeling. If someone's lashing out in that manner, it's probably because they're scared. They have a fear of what's about to happen,
mm-hmm.
and even though you might have absolutely approached the conversation from a place of concern and care,
mm-hmm.
If they're feeling threatened, then it's probably for a good reason. And so just taking the moment to take a deep breath and not take that personally, or not
mm-hmm.
read more into it than other than in that moment this person is feeling threatened, and what can we do to lower those fences so they know that this is okay in terms mm-hmm. of coming to us for help.
And I think this is a significant time for allied health or mental health professionals to be available. Because I think if you don't know how to read that, the tendency is you may become defensive, and then you've broken down lines of communication. The other thing I want to talk about is shame and guilt. And I learned this significantly as I did my internship on the clinical staff at University of California. Guilt is something you can deal with. You can use it as motivation to change behavior. But what I learned about shame is, say, for instance, something turns out bad. A behavior decision. You see yourself as that decision. So you see yourself as bad, rather than you can't separate yourself from the circumstances. And I have figured out shame is one of our biggest enemies, because we have to deal with ourselves, and we can't purge, we can't fix us. So do you see, based on your experience, shame percolating up? Do women talk about it?
Absolutely. I think on both sides. So when we speak to victims of domestic violence, they mm-hmm. they often report an incredible sense of shame that they're in this situation to begin with,
mm-hmm.
that maybe they've stayed longer than they wished to,
mm-hmm.
Shame that their children might be experiencing this too.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also some really good work being done right now in the field of working with people who commit acts of domestic violence, so offenders,
okay,
in the sense of the shame that they feel.
Talk about
where that comes from. So the program that I work for uses what we call a compassion model. So we're working with people who have committed acts of domestic violence against their family members, but we're there to support them in changing their behavior, and, you know, they need to have some accountability for what they've done. But addressing the root of the behavior from a place of compassion, and how can we help you change in the future? And looking at the shame, looking at shame and guilt as, like you said, motivators for change, but also healing from mm-hmm. things that have happened in the past.
Yeah, this is a tough place to just sit down and have conversation about, because experiences and people are marching through my mind. Memories are being awakened, and self-compassion, that's one of the hardest things we can do, is to love us in our imperfection. I always think of my imperfections, of which there are many, as gifts because they allow me opportunities to grow. In your capacity, and we haven't even talked about what you're doing for the county. What kind of work do you do? Why are you even here at the table? Why are you an expert?
Sure. So currently I'm the countywide domestic violence coordinator for Fairfax County in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
In that role, I help coordinate across our system to make sure that all of the systems that might interact with either victims or offenders are working together to ensure that what we have, what we call a coordinated community response to domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that from every door a victim or offender might enter in our system, that we all are providing trauma-informed services, that we are working together to make sure the outcomes are best for those families, and to make sure that the staff that are doing this work and the volunteers doing this work are providing the highest quality services we possibly can.
So I wrote down the word measurements. So how do you know how you're doing?
Well, it's hard to do that in the world of domestic violence.
Yes.
What looks like success for some might be different than others.
Okay.
So if you're looking at a victim-centered approach, one way we measure success, a lot of times people think it might be, you know, how many people left an abusive relationship.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
How many people came and got services. We look at it as if a victim of domestic violence has come to us as a victim services agency, are they getting what they hoped for? Are they feeling safer now?
Okay.
As a result of interacting with us.
Okay.
Which is hard to measure.
Yes.
But we do our best.
Yes.
And we also look at, you know, are the offenders coming through our program taking accountability for their previous behavior, and are recidivism rates lower?
Mm-hmm.
Are rates in general going down? So those are some of the things that we look
well,
at.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you have group counseling focused at domestic violence?
So we do. Our office does provide group counseling for victims of domestic violence as well as victims of sexual assault.
Okay.
And then we also provide a psychoeducational group for people who have committed acts of domestic violence against a partner.
So it's probably behavioral therapy there.
Correct.
Okay, so you just used two terms, sexual abuse and domestic violence. Are they twins? Are they one and the same? What are they?
I think they're sisters. So, So sexual violence happens quite often within intimate partner relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So within the context of domestic violence, we see that. And we also know that victims of domestic violence who are also being sexually assaulted or their partners using sexual coercion are at greater risk in terms of lethality or the danger of that relationship leading into a homicide.
Yes.
So that correlation can be quite dangerous. We also know that they are different in some ways, because someone can sexually assault you outside of the context of a relationship. So we know that sexual assaults occur by other people in our lives. But generally speaking, sexual violence happens most often by someone that we know and trust.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And everything we've talked about, in my mind, I'm hearing is a matter of control, controlling one person over another. And can you speak a little bit about the intergenerational transfer of, like, if I've lived the life, I've observed this, mommy didn't leave, it just became a pattern of behavior. Daddy screamed, mommy couldn't do this, she didn't have her own money. Do I have a tendency when I grow up, when I'm dating, when I'm in high school, well, when I'm 10 years old now, dating, do I take any of that behavior or cues from that to become more violent?
So there's absolutely research to show that, yes, people who have experienced domestic violence as a child, witnessing their partners,
mm-hmm.
or I mean their parents, abuse one another, can become victims or abusers themselves later in life. However, it's really important to understand that even if you experience that, or if you are an adult victim of domestic violence with children, mm-hmm. you can interrupt that now. You can stop that. It doesn't necessarily mean just because you as a child witness this that you're going to become either a victim or offender.
Is it a decision? Or,
you know, there's a lot of work being done right now on resiliency in children, especially children who have experienced traumas.
Okay.
And protective factors. So there's great research to help us understand where does that divide start to happen? Where do children either make a decision or take a different path? Right. And it's important, I think, to always remind, especially the victims that we've been working with, is just because your child witnessed this does not mean that they're going to grow up to be an offender,
right,
or a victim themselves.
Uh-huh.
Many children observe this and grow up and say, not at all. Like, I am not going to follow in those footsteps because I know how dangerous it is. And that's where resilience comes in.
Okay.
So we know that children who have at least one adult in their life that can support them and that they can trust. It doesn't even have to be a parent, mm-hmm. although it certainly can be.
Mm-hmm.
That those children are far less likely to have a multitude of problems as they grow older. So that trusting adult is a huge protective factor that we want all kids to have.
Absolutely. And that's such a thin line, right? Because we naturally think of sports. We think of scouts. We think of church. And right now, every Monday morning, I send encouraging texts to about 7 young women who are seniors or going off to college to let them know, no matter what's going on, you are loved. And I think you're absolutely correct. Parents have one role, but to have a nurturing adult outside of that that can maybe say the same words that are coming from a parent's mouth, can be received differently and maybe, you know, change. I was thinking when you're talking about just because you're in that house doesn't mean, and I know several people who grew up with parents who drink or smoke. And I'm not smoking. I'm not drinking. So I'm pleased to hear that it's possible that a child can make that decision to turn, right? I'm going to do this. I'm going to take a short break. And then I want us to talk about legislation trends, but I also want to talk about what we have, the elephant in the room, our men victim of sexual violence. Okay? And we are back. I asked Nicole to walk into that space that we managed to avoid thus far, talking about domestic violence. And the question is, are men a part of this problem? Of course they are. Are men recipients victims of domestic violence? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so absolutely. Men, anyone can become a victim of domestic violence. So domestic violence is not no bounds when it comes to gender, race, ethnicity, age, socioeconomic status.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that women are quite disproportionately affected by domestic violence.
Okay.
So many more women are victims of domestic violence than men.
Mm-hmm.
But men face some unique challenges as victims of domestic violence. I think in our society, it's something we don't talk about very often.
Mm-hmm.
So there can often be a sense of shame or guilt associated with reporting it or reaching out for help. And it's also important to understand that domestic violence can happen in the context of same-sex relationships. In fact, trans people are much more likely to be victimized with violence, just
mm-hmm.
in general. And
mm-hmm.
so it's really important that we as a community and as service providers create safe spaces for everyone to come forward who needs help.
I picked up this quote as an example of what you just said. And this is from CDC, actually, both of the things I'm going to talk about. He called a hotline for battered women's program and asked about services for men, explaining that he was experiencing violence at the hand of a female. The hotline worker said, "You should be in jail." The officer restated that he needed help because his wife was violent. The hotline worker hung up on him. And that's anecdotal, obviously. But I think we are still driven by role and expectations. This is also from the CDC. According to the CDC, 1 in 4 adult men in the U.S. will become a victim of domestic violence during his lifetime. That's upwards of 3 million male domestic violence victims every year, or one man in America abused by an intimate or domestic partner. Oh, this is scary. Every 32nd, 8 seconds. So for those of you listening, this is not a mutually exclusive club. And again, I want to say, yeah, it's about control over one person. Talk about legislation trends. No, do this. Tell the audience what you want them to know. What's the most important thing you want them to take away from this discussion?
I think the most important thing I would want people to know is that we are all in a position to, if you care about this issue, to do something about it. I think sometimes when we hear statistics like the ones you mentioned, it can feel overwhelming, mm-hmm. the scope of the problem, and it can feel very overwhelming to think, what can I do about that as just one person?
Right, right.
But what we've seen over time is that changing society norms can be as simple as saying something if you see something. It can be as simple as if you hear somebody making maybe a joke about domestic or sexual violence, confront that person and explain why that's offensive to you. It can really mean something on a bigger level. It can mean using your power when it comes to your workplace. Everyone has a sphere of influence in which they can do something about this. If you're part of a civic group, a community group, a religious group, you know, talk to the leaders of that group about what can we do to support organizations doing this work? What can we do to make this a safe community? There are a lot of things we can all do and a lot of resources available. Most communities, at least here in Virginia, have domestic and sexual violence programs that do outreach and prevention work. Invite them in. They are always looking for new groups to talk to about this, and they can help you. So that's what I'd like people to know, is this isn't just a behind closed doors issue. This is something that affects everybody. I would challenge us to find every person listening can probably think of at least one person they know that's been impacted personally by this, if they themselves haven't been.
I agree with you 159%. How's that? So to recap, if you see something, say something. If you hear language in the workplace, jokes being told, be authentic enough, brave enough to say, hey, you know, I'm not feeling good about this, so I'm going to step away. And you're not asking them to do anything. You're calling attention to the topic and how uncomfortable you are in that space. And generally, my experience has been, particularly when I was working with IBM and most of my clients were men, when they went to that place where I was not comfortable, I had to learn to say, you know what, I'm going to step away for a few minutes. I'll be back, kind of thing. But also, this one I love. Every one of us has a sphere of influence. Every single one of us. And maybe we don't want to step into that because you do risk judgment. So I guess what we're saying to ourselves and to our listeners is it's be brave and understand there's some things you can do where you can't fail. And being authentic and vulnerable, hey, you know, what's the worst thing that could happen, right? Programs. There are programs. We have that magic word that's become a verb, Google. And if you Google domestic violence, sexual abuse, pages and pages and pages come up with statistics and programming Did you do your homework? I asked you to write a letter.
I did.
You did?
Yes.
Well, I'm going to ask you to do your homework and read your letter that you wrote, please, to your younger self. And generally what comes out of this exercise for those of you listening is people say, you know what? I didn't want to do it. It wasn't right. It didn't feel right. But it's good. It's okay. I hope you came up on that side of it. Did you, Nicole?
Yes.
Oh. That didn't sound right. But okay, let's give it a try.
So it's not about domestic violence. I just wrote it to myself.
Good.
All right. Dear Nicole, greetings from your future self. I'm sure right now you're excited to hear from me so I can give you all the wisdom and confidence you're seeking as a new social worker that's eager to start changing the world. But I have to admit, I'm still figuring this out for myself. But I've learned a few things so far that I feel like would have helped you to hear when we were younger. Here they are. 1, some days you will question if what you're doing is actually helping anyone. The most important thing you haven't learned yet is just being present and holding someone's feelings for them can be transformative. So don't underestimate the power of just being present for another person. 2, the discomfort of change and conflict can be uncomfortable, and sometimes you'll want to run away from that. But the best things come from that too. So if change or disagreement make you uncomfortable, you need to hang in there and figure out why. And finally, don't get lost in the perfect and try to control the world around you as you try to make change in the world. The world's a messy place, and if you wait for things to be perfect before you move ahead, you'll always be right where you are. You're going to go on to do some things you would not believe you had the courage to do, and you'll also make some decisions you regret. And that's all right. Regret is our brain's way of telling you that you need to do some things differently, and that's where we need to grow. So hang in there, and you're going to do a great job.
I like that. What I took away from your letter, which I think is so significant, be present, show up. And I would add to that my own words, show up understanding that you're worthy. Show up understanding that you're not alone. Show up understanding that you are not your circumstance. Show up understanding you have everything inside of you need to be the person you were created to be. I want to read a couple of words for your spiritual doggy bags. This is for the time when you're sitting there, or maybe you're not sitting, maybe you're working hard, maybe you're driving the kids, maybe you're keeping from saying something ugly to your spouse. I don't know. But there are moments when we just say, you know what, I'm tired. I don't want to do this anymore. When that moment comes, it's okay. It's okay. We forget that there is nothing inside of us or nothing that we are missing. There is no need to frantically become more, be more, do more, get more. You are whole and complete, and we're gifted every talent and insight you needed to thrive in this world. At the moment you were born, your only job is to accept this truth and then allow it to unfold. Some insights only become clear to you once you have life experiences that unlock such wisdom from within you. Trust in this and relax. My next favorite thing to share is that perfection is a man-made illusion. We are beautifully imperfect beings operating in a very imperfect world. And that is just the way it's meant to be. Striving for perfection is a hollow goal, one that can never be achieved. Society shows us doctored images of perfection constantly in marketing, social media, opinions, and expectations. Do not buy into this illusion. It will only lead you to the fact that life is a roller coaster at times. Sure, strive for excellence. Have high standards, but never confuse that with the crippling behavior of perfectionism. Nicole Acosta, what a pleasure sharing this hour with you. This was a courageous conversation. People just don't sit around and say, hey, what you do last night? Well, I talked about domestic violence and what I'm going to do to intervene. No. But I felt it was important, if I was going to be true to my audience, to talk about things that are important, we need to have on the table. And we have a virtual global table of women who are phenomenal. And you happen to be one of those. I want to let everyone know your seat is guaranteed at the table. You're listening to RadioFairfax.org. And our guest has been Miss Nicole Acosta. If there is someone that wants to know, hey, I need help, can you give them a place or somewhere to call in Virginia or just generally?
Yeah, so I would recommend in the U.S., the National Domestic Violence Hotline, which you can just Google, and they even have text options too. So if you're not comfortable speaking on the phone, that's one
great
option.
Oh, great, yeah.
And then the National Rape, Assault, Incest National Network Hotline is a great place to get support if you're a victim of sexual assault.
Did you all hear that? All you have to do is Google. More importantly, all you have to do is tell someone that you love and trust. Take good care. Bye now.